a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
I'm too sleepy to roll. Can we just crawl?
Take the leap, Andrea.
It's a leap. You know what? It's 11, Nate. That reminds me. I had a guy I was supposed to call the other day at noon. So because I texted him, I said, "Hey, can I call you at 12 tomorrow?" And then I said, "That would be noon, not midnight." I said, "Pool players got to specify."
Demetrius, that's you funny. Made that joke last episode.
Did I?
Yeah. What are you doing? You can't recycle jokes.
I don't remember these things. I just that can't be because I just had that conversation with this guy. No, I had this conversation with a guy like Monday. Unless we did a podcast, that can't be.
Maybe I don't know. Maybe you just told me about it. I know I heard that story. So maybe it was when we were watching the match together.
Probably because I said yeah because I sent the guy the text this Sunday. So that's. Cutting edge. This is like fresh off the press. It hasn't even hit Netflix yet.
That's the kind of content we have today. This is what we're going to be offering up. Fun stuff, huh?
We're talking pool, man. Right. I see Mazen Shuni's got a three cushion tournament now coming up. He's up in September at the Dennis Diekman Memorial. I'm going to talk to Austin Hill and see if he can make a Dennis Diekman. Same style and stuff of cues, billiard cues that he made, because there's nobody out there making them anymore like that.
You know, I'm not much of a cue guy, but you know, Rob, I'll tell you, I've always had one idea for a custom cue, and that would be to have different, like, colorful gems and stones that are inlays, and you have all of the Lucky Charm marshmallows, you know, like the purple hearts and the horseshoes and the lightning bolts and the red balloons and the green cloverleaf. And then check this out, right on the butt of your cue, where the normally like the brand goes, you have Lucky the Leprechaun.
Yeah.
How cool would that be?
A Looney Tunes stick, yeah.
Well, you got to have some rainbows just in there somewhere.
The Lucky Charms cue. Now, of course, yeah, I mean, right. It'll be like not PC here in about another 3 months and, you know, yeah. Having a leprechaun in your queue, you probably couldn't play internationally, play you know, on the East Coast or whatever, but
well, you know,
it would be fun.
With the some of the sticks that are decal cues that are very intricate, I mean, there literally is, your imagination could go anywhere for what you want to put on a table or a cue. Have you seen, there's some pool tables over here in Wisconsin where you have, instead of the diamonds around the table, you'll have small fishing lures placed in, you know, epoxy around the table. And, oh, yeah, log table frames, like a log cabin, only the table is logs. And with these inlaid little baits and stuff, oh, yeah, there's a few people in the state that are doing that kind of stuff. But what do? One table every 3 years, you know.
Do we hate that as much as we hate themed pool cloth?
No, you know, you said you don't mind that, and I was just wondering if you guys.
Well, I just said there was a time and a place for it.
I just thought it was goofy. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and it's not a serious pool environment, that's for sure.
But I think jump cues are goofy, so here you go.
Hey, knock it off. I control the mute button, buddy. You don't talk bad about my primary mode of transportation.
Yeah, you get jumping in. That's why you say jump into the podcast.
That's what I'm saying, man.
No, I get it.
Yeah, it's not so hard.
You don't have a leap cue. Why not? Why don't we have a leap cue?
I don't even know what's happening
here,
with my life
anymore. Here, I have a special
leap
cue here. Maybe I invent a leap cue.
I don't even know what's happening anymore, Rob. But I think we need to get started because I'm already bored, so I know the listeners are. And I don't want to lose any of our 4 listeners that we have left. So here we go. Announcements in the beginning. All right, we are going to start this off with some exciting news from, I guess, me. We are going to be working with the Break Rack in the coming months. And I know that I said that I am not going to be taking advertisers from inside the industry. And I am basically going to be, I guess, turning that back on itself now. I've shared in the past that I was hoping to get advertisements through a third-party ad that works with my podcast, but with COVID, podcast listening across the board is pretty much down about 20%. And I think a lot of that is because people generally listen to podcasts on their way to work. And I guess with the giant decrease in listeners, a lot of the marketing that was pushed through podcast has now been slowed down quite dramatically. So I am going to basically open up advertising again to anybody who wants to advertise through the podcast, at least for the near future. So if you own a company, whether it's inside the pool world or not, and you want to, I guess, broaden that reach that you have with your company out to a larger group from around the world, because I do have listeners, regular listeners in about 28 different countries, and I have at least partial listeners in, I think, 89 different countries now. So if you want to reach out to a much larger audience and get your word out, maybe you're doing some sort of marketing thing coming up soon, or maybe you just want to support the podcast and maybe get some advertising out there at the same time, reach out to me, myself, and we will talk about what it's going to take for that to happen. And it's pretty cheap, actually, so you don't really have to worry about paying too much for it. So it's probably a good thing on both sides, on all sides, and we could help you, you can help us, and I guess that could be a good thing. But going back to the original announcement, the break rack, this is probably, and I'm uniquely qualified probably to talk about this because my break is so god-awful, but the break rack is probably the most influential piece of equipment as far as training that I can think of in the entire world of pool. And anybody who's been around the podcast for a long time knows that this is definitely a product I believe in. I've talked about it for free, and I've pushed it for free. And I think actually one of my tips once was to get a break rack, actually, if you could afford it. So this is definitely a perfect product that I want to be talking about in the near future. And, you know, I've been doing it in the past for free, and now I have a reason to even more, because they are going to be partnering with the podcast and really helping us do what we see that we can do over here from this side of the street with promoting pool. And they agree with it, and they want to help, you know, benefit that. And we want to help benefit them, because they really do have one of the best products in the entire market in pool today. So we will have more news on this to come in the coming weeks. But just know that Break Rack will be a regular part of the podcast for the coming months, starting, I guess, with probably the next episode. So I guess that is going to be the announcements as far as the advertisements go. So we're partnering with Break Rack, and if you would like to partner with the podcast as well, please reach out to myself or the podcast, or queueitupodcast.com. There is a contact us page, and we'll move on from there. And so today I'm dropping this at 10 o'clock my time. In 3 hours from now, I am going to be doing a live Facebook interview with Emily Frazier. It's pretty last second. If you get to it and you want to watch it, tune into Facebook in 3 hours, or I guess I can't really do that because this is a podcast, right? So tune in at 1 p.m. Central Time, 2 Eastern, 11 West Coast Time. And you can ask any questions that you want to Emily Frazier via the chat. And if they're good questions, I will get them incorporated into the conversation that we have. So feel free to tune in, check that out. I will make it into a podcast regardless and release it if you are not able to tune in. And I guess that is pretty much all I have to say. There's no new Patreon updates, but same as always, if you're interested in finding out more about it, you can reach out to myself, the podcast, or the website. And I guess from there, we can jump into our shout-outs. Who wants to go first? Don't all jump at once.
Well, I got a shout-out to John Logan at the Minneapolis Billiard Club. I'm not sure what's being edited in or out of our little conversation, so I'll just recap. I went to the Minneapolis Billiard Club this weekend and to meet my old man, my buddy Matt Lind, and we played a little three-cushion billiards, by which I mean he played three-cushion billiards, and I attempted a bunch of shots that Venom would try when he's feeling groggy. Oh, yeah. And so anyway, while I was there, I ran into John Logan, who is playing a really fun. This guy, man, he plays billiards nice. I mean, he's not like some, you know, national-level tournament player or anything like that, But, you know, he's just one of those guys that goes to the club and plays, and he plays for himself, and he plays because of the beauty of the game. And I'll tell you, every time I saw him leg at the balls, man, every time he legged at the balls, and it's like, I know, I guess billiard players could do this. And so, but he's kicking, you know, 3, 4, 5 rails, catching the right side of the ball. I didn't see him miss a kick, Rob. It was just amazing, you know.
Oh, yeah,
and it just, he's not just the right angle. But the right speed to really just clip him the right way. Anyway, so every time I look over, he's making some finesse shot. And I'm over here hammering the balls around with, you know, force follow and just, you know, trying to draw my ball 5 rails and stuff. It's just, I just felt like a complete, you know, bullet in China shot. But anyway, John, here's the point, though, is he said something really nice. He said that he listened to every one of our episodes. He really liked the podcast. And he said that, you know, he'd taken some things away, you know, and as far as improvement, entertainment, it just, and it was cool. Now I know that, for those of you guys like Nate, I know you're out in public a lot and you're very active in the community. And so you hear a lot of positive feedback, but, I am pretty reclusive. I've been sheltering at home for a while, and I guess it's just fun to run into people that actually listen and enjoy. So to all the listeners, shout out to all of our listeners and supporters, but spearheaded this week for me by, Mr. John. So Logan and
he's quite a systems guy too. He knows some perfectly, has all the books on the systems and
I tried to use the Diamond 5, which is like, as anybody knows, it's like adding 1 + 1 when it comes to 3 cushion. Yep. It's like the basic, simplest system. And it's been so long since I've played, like legitimately, I started calculating. I'm like, well, I need to come in at, you know, 5.8 and I'm coming through, and I started doing the parallel and then I stopped. And it was almost like when you're trying to speak a language you haven't spoke for a long time and you just draw a blank on the word. I was sitting there staring at it and it's just gone. And I'm like, well, I'll just put it there then.
Right.
It's like, it's funny. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, there's shortcuts. Once you learn a system, you personalize the system to yourself and take little shortcuts with it. And that's why these better players, they use feel, of course, too, but then all this knowledge, they do it very quickly. It's kind of cool that way. When I'm doing the corner 5 system now, I look at the 4th rail. That's all I look at. And I have put numbers on that 4th rail. And if I say a number to myself on the 4th rail, I know exactly on the 1st rail where I got to hit to get that number on the 4th rail. It's just memorized now. And that helps things flow along pretty nice. And you usually come real close to that too. Yeah. Okay, my shout-out here this week is special. It's been done before. This has been shout-out before. I think Demi shouted out before, but I got to do it again. I'm going to shout out to the editor, the producer, the director, the choreographer, and the makeup man for Cue It Up podcast.
What?
Nate Mindum.
The hell did I do?
Is my shout out, and especially for what he did and started to do last night. And he's helping the pool world and industry by donating his time to helping pool players get better. And at the same time doing that, encouraging business for his friends who are pool players and own a pool place. So my shout out is to you, Nate, for that. Now I would like you to explain to the listeners how it all went for the first night. You're giving a free pool lesson out to people. How many people did you have there? How'd it go? Stuff like that. Listeners might want to hear that.
Oh, I'm going to start crying pretty soon, Rob. You're so sweet. The first night, it was a little bit less than what I was hoping for, but it's a really weird time in Dane County, Wisconsin, which is where Madison is located, because we are under not 100% lockdown, but we are under a pretty strict lockdown. So the only way that you can actually go into a pool hall is if that pool hall serves food and if you order food. So they have an outdoor patio, which you could go into, and basically there's no restrictions out there besides social distance, which the stupidest statement in the history of forever is social distancing at a bar. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. That doesn't happen. So to be inside where the actual lessons are happening, you have food and you have to be wearing a mask. So there's a lot of people that's, you know, that kind of eliminates immediately because they're not willing to do one or both or, you know, either of them. So we ended up having 5 people show up, which is, you know, not too bad.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I ended up learning quite a bit, and I haven't done a ton of marketing for it besides, I guess, on Facebook. So I posted to my wall, and I posted to a local pool group, and I'm going to do a lot more marketing from now until next week. I'm going to hang some flyers around at some of the more popular league bars, and my goal is more or less to get people who don't play pool but are interested in playing pool, or maybe they play pool once a week, and they just kind of hang out with their buddies, but they really like the game. And my goal for that demographic is more or less to introduce more people to the game, because the people that are 550, 600 level Fargos, like I'm happy to work. I'm very happy to work with them. I want to see them improve their games, and I think that I have a lot of things that could help with that. But really, my goal is to try to introduce more people to the game, because if we don't get, as someone once said this, there's a lot of people. There are few people entering this game. There are a lot of people leaving this game. And that kind of says where our demographic of pool players is. It tends to be pretty older individuals, whether it's 45 and above or 35 and above, whatever it is. It's not a young man's game in the U.S. So my goal is ultimately just to get more people involved with the game and teach people the actual art of the game, because pool is not a game. It's more of an art when you actually know how the game works and how, I guess, there's a reason and a method for everything that happens on the pool table at a high level. So I guess that's kind of my goal, is to try to do what I can to get more people introduced to the game and introduced to the game in the right way. So I guess it's going to be a process. I'm learning as we go. I did some things last night that are not going to be reproducible. I want to work, you know, individually with one person for 15 minutes and really correct everything that I see wrong with them. And it's just not going to work that way. So it's, you know, I'm kind of learning, you know, it's got to be 2 to 3 minutes to pop with each individual person, move on to the next one, give them something to work on for 10 minutes, and then come back and make sure that, you know, they're going along well with what I had them working on. So it's going to be a learning process for me. So it's a good thing that only a couple people showed up, 5 people showed up the first night. It allowed me to kind of get a better game plan going forward. So I guess, I don't know, I probably answered that one a little bit too much in depth, but that's kind of my takeaways from the first night of it.
So how did it go then, the first night? I mean, all in all, what do you give yourself a grade? Did you do pretty good for the first night?
Well, I guess the way I look at it, it depends less on how I did in the first night and how each student comes back the next week, right? So I tried to leave everybody going away with something that they can work on. Maybe 2 things if what I gave them was a little bit simpler, to come back with the next week on, to work on their own time with, to basically keep the progress moving towards the game that I hope to see them with. So, for example, I'll pick on Rick Porter because he's an avid listener to the podcast, and he came down last night. So what I did with him was, he's not a beginner player, but he's not super seasoned either, so he's somewhere in between there. And what I did with him is I installed the pause. And I gave him the full rundown at why the pause is important in one stroke. So, you know, I made the analogy that you can't, if you're stroking back and forth like a wild man, and Justin Bergman does this, especially when he does his practice strokes off to the side, he sits there and he swings a cue really, really quickly between his fingers. But before he pulls a trigger, you see that pause. And that pause is there to basically straighten out. You're basically starting over from scratch, right? So if you're swinging back and forth like a wild man and your second to last stroke is just a little outside to in or inside to out, you can't, if it's all part of the same motion when you're stroking the cue and you're going from that outside to in to your final stroke and expect that to be straight, it just doesn't work like that. You can't go from, you can't go from an imperfect stroke and transition directly into a perfect stroke. So that's why that pause is really important, whether it's in the back of your stroke or whether it's in the front of your stroke. It's starting you up from zero to where you are always stroking from the same spot every single time. You're not stroking a little bit faster or a little bit slower. It's consistency every single time, starting from zero. And
when did you guys start seeing that pause? How long ago? Because 40 years ago, I can't even remember a pause being part of a pool stroke.
Oh, I'm a bad person to ask for this because I'm only 12 years old. So, Demetrius, maybe you can answer this.
It's definitely true that in the – well, I didn't start playing until the 90s, but I got to watch a lot of players, you know, VHS tapes from the 80s. And it's definitely true that there was a very wide range of fundamentals. And so the consistency between top player to top player was just not there. You saw all kinds of different styles. So there were people that had a real, real strong fundamentals. You know, of course, Buddy Hall was known to have a real nice slow backswing and a good pause in the backswing. Different things were, and then, you know, nice accelerating stroke. But there was also guys, like Keith McCready or Jimmy Mattia, the guy, you know, just guys with real flashy kind of wind up strokes. And of course, the other part of it is that the game has evolved. So, you know, you go back to straight pool and people had totally different fundamentals. So it's hard to pick. But what I will say is, I don't know that the pause is anything new or the slow backswing. But what I will say is that what is new is that in the last 10 years, if you look at fundamentals across all the players, it's become much more cookie cutter. Even guys like Ralph Souquet and stuff had a little quirks. But now you look at guys like James Aranas and, you know, different players from the Philippines and different players from Europe and different players from China and Japan. And you look at them all, and they're all very, very, very similar in how they play.
Yeah.
And so that's where when you see it, you know, it used to be that the, you know, Filipino players were just kind of like the, you know, the street fighters, as I say, you know, the gamblers, and they kind of grew up with the whip strokes and the loosey teaspoon grips and the, you know, the pump handle strokes. And now it's like, it's all cookie cutter. So in short, the pause has been around for a while, but it's become universal in the last 10 years.
About 10? I think that's about when I saw it, maybe, you know, back in the late, even later than the late 90s, 10, yeah, maybe the middle 2000s.
Yeah. So
a lot of the ladies from Europe came here, started playing in tournaments over here in the United States, and they had these pauses. I think that's where I first saw it.
So I guess going back to your original question, I don't know exactly how it went until I see how people come back next week. So Rick Porter, I gave him the homework of incorporating that pause into his stroke and one other thing, but I'm not really sure what else that was. And the second thing I gave him was treating every shot as if it's the same one. So, for example, he likes to...
Very important.
when the shot gets a little bit tougher, he likes to kind of jump up a little bit through his shot. And I kind of pulled him off to the side. I'm like, you know, kind of gave him, again, a little analogy on why I think that that's going to hinder his game in the long run.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I do think staying down on your shot is less important than... most other aspects of your shot, just because, you know, if you jump up through your shot, the contact's already been made. So if everything's set, like Randy Lemar, for example, is a perfect example of that. He jumps up on every single shot he shoots, but as long as the delivery is pure, it doesn't really matter if your head is through the ceiling once that cue ball's, you know, made contact with the object ball. I mean, it's less important than the lead up to the shot, but it's not going to hurt you to stay down on your shots and, you know, kind of watch them go in the hole. But with that being said, I mean,
fun too.
Yeah. So, you know, I gave him the two homework assignments of incorporating the pause and, really, really emphasize the stay down and treatment of every shot is the same. So if he comes back next week,
right away, I bet on that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And if he comes back next week or the week after that, or whenever he's able to get down here again, cause he lives over in Milwaukee. So, you know, if I see some headway and some, you know, some solid improvement on the things that I'm having him work on, then I would say that last night was successful. And if, you know, if he comes back and he's got some of the same habits, and then we just got to, you know, find ways to reach, you know, a different way and try to see if we can get him working towards some things.
For you, that's got to be just real rewarding, is to see a one comment moment in time with a student, a boot camp a player, and have it change their game immediately.
I've really enjoyed one of the things I like is that, you know, I when I work with my students, because most of them are flying in from all across the country, what that does is, you know, there's a bell curve distribution of people that are like, you know, very recreational, don't really want to get better at pool, versus people that are really gung-ho and really ready to, you know, take their game to the next level. And in pool, I get kind of somewhat discouraged at times, not really discouraged, but just kind of like I have a burning fire, and I see a lot of people. Like I went to, there was a challenge match I was watching on Friday with my best friend, was playing, you know, a guy in a challenge match. Anyway, I was watching this match and looking around this room at the tournament room, and most players in the room are kind of like, you know, just kind of socializing, drinking beers, hitting balls, and they're playing, they're hitting, walking around and hitting balls around, kind of, you know, half trying, but not really all in. And they're playing the same level they've played for 10 or 20 years, and they haven't really, they just kind of decided, like, well, you know, it'd be pretty hard to get much better from here, so we'll just kind of run it, and I'll win once in a while when things go my way. And I'll just take it when it comes. And when I'm, you know, when things aren't going well, then I'll just lose. And when things are going well, then I'll bear down and try. And I'll try to make it happen. But if not, you know, whatever. It's just this kind of attitude. And it kind of saps me, man. It's just not my style. It's not my scene. So walking into a pool room where there's half the people are kind of disengaged, it's hard for me. But I've been spoiled because I've only been working and talking to people that are flying across the country to work with me. So everyone I talk to is all in, super hungry, and it's been really rewarding. So I just, not only has it been rewarding in terms of seeing people have breakthroughs and push and change the way they look at pool, but it's just refreshing to always be talking with serious students where we're all sharing that same level of passion.
Yeah.
So I guess we can probably wrap it up there. I will do my shout out. My shout out is going to go to Eric Kwan, and he was pretty high up with Q-Tech and Imperial, and I kind of made a connection with him, I guess, when I was doing the Q at Up Cups and some of the live interviews. And I just chatted with him every now and then on Facebook. And we had a couple connections back and forth with a couple different projects that we were working on between the two of us. And it was just it was a pleasure to get to work with him. And he's actually leaving Q-Tech and Imperial now. So best wishes to you, Eric. And I mean, I don't know how many people actually know who he is. I'm sure a couple people will. But it was a pleasure getting to work with you for the last couple months. And I guess best wishes in whatever your journey is from here. So I guess that's a pretty long introduction to the podcast, but I don't know. What else do we have to do, right? Let's go. Let's hop, skip, and wiggle into the podcast.
Yeah, man, let's leap into this, baby.
Jesus, Rob, I've never heard you so excited for anything in my life.
Well, my ass stopped hurting a little.
Well,
I swung so hard at a golf ball 3 years ago, I tore the big muscle in your rear end.
Your gluteus maximus?
And it's whatever. It's I just popped it, and now it's still not fixed. But I'm coming over that Minneapolis way to get a little prolotherapy done on it on the 23rd, Demi.
Well, congratulations. You're doing all this prolotherapy, and there are people in the podcast like David Dukes, who's been reaching out to you trying to find out about
David Dukes, the bowler.
Dave Dukes.
Huh.
Well, I assume it's David. I don't know. He has been even emailing the podcast. He actually bought a couple hoodies that I got to send to Canada, so that was fun.
Oh wow!
And he's been trying to contact you. I even gave him your number and everything, and he said you just never answer. And now he's mad, and he hasn't been happy since.
Well, my wife is in control of the telephone lately. She won't let me. She thinks I have a girlfriend somewhere. She won't let me near the phone.
Well, there you go, Dave.
She's at work now. That's the only reason I'm on the podcast.
You just got to call and leave a message, and then Rob will get back to you. I was supposed to send this via email about 2 weeks ago, but then I forgot, so I guess I can't really shame you too much, Rob.
I don't look at my emails too much.
Well, and to our listeners, they can now play a game where they try to decode Rob's cries for help through the podcast. He's going to be leaving like coded messages, trapped in an apartment. Please, wife listening to my podcast now. Please, yeah, send firemen. Yeah, I don't know.
You can take a plane over his house and you can see in his little pond he's got a bunch of lily pads in a formation that says help me.
Snapping turtle in there this year.
He's dropping messages. You know, Gomez during the match, he just couldn't get out when he needed to. You know what I mean? He needed help to get out, you know? Anyway, forget it.
Poor stuff. Poor stuff. Here we are. We had a big match, and it was actually a well.
What
I'm
was the final score, man? I don't even know.
191.
Ooh, Denny, what did you were close?
No, I mean, at the end, I think I said 183, but I knew that it was going to be. But anyway, we can get into the match in a bit. I'll let Nate summarize. Wow.
This was man. Maybe it's just my takeaway from it's not right, but this is one of the weirdest races to 100 I think I've ever seen. There was a power outage on day two, which stopped the entire day's action. That game in day three where Justin breaks and makes five balls. He makes three stripes and two solids, and he has to take stripes at that point in time, but he shoots in a solid. And then Gomez calls a foul on him, goes over and grabs the balls, pulls him up on the table to show him that he had to take stripes. And then, so that makes Justin Bergman stripes. So what does Roberto Gomez? He calls a foul, doesn't take ball in hand, and then proceeds to shoot stripes in, even though he was solids and just called a foul because Justin took the wrong balls. Runs all the way down to the eight ball, and then Justin Bergman calls a foul on him. Which, by BCA rules, and I don't know the exact rules they were playing by, but by BCA rules, you can't call a foul once the player gets to the eight ball. So once Roberto Gomez gets to that eight ball, Justin Bergman can no longer call a foul on it for shooting the wrong balls because he is now the eight ball, not solids or stripes in that case. So that was just a really, really weird game. And then it just seemed like Roberto Gomez could be anywhere else in the world from there. And for about the next 10 games, and well, maybe not 10 games, about the next 5 games. And then he just gets onto this loose tear where he just starts walking around the table and just firing at everything 150 miles an hour, just like trying to fake a stroke, and eventually finds it. He ends up playing a little bit better from there. But it just seemed like there was the trends of the match. Justin Bergman gets down big 22-11, I think it was, in the first day, and then ends up winning 35-29. And Roberto Gomez comes out on day two and immediately makes up that. I think he got it back to 36-36 or 37-37, something like that. And then they trade racks, get up three games, down three games. How many double digit leads were given up in that match? Probably four.
Yeah. So this is what was really interesting. And just to kind of give the play by play on the day by day. So for people that didn't see the match, Justin Bergman and Roberto Gomez played a race to 100, take what you make, big table, eight ball. And the day one score, Bergman ended up on top 35-29. As Nate said, he was actually trailing by 11 games and finished up six, 35-29. Day two, they actually tied up at 47 apiece, and they were supposed to play until 70. But as Nate mentioned, there was a power outage, and because the stream and the lights were shut down, it was so bad, they're like, there's no ETA on when they're going to get the lights back on. So they had to call it for day two. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But then they come back on day three. They played 80 games instead of finishing the match, which means that it went to a four-day. So the day three, Bergman ended up ahead 80-72, and then he maintained that lead, finishing 100-91. And so that was a really interesting – but those were the day-by-day results. That was the game they played. And, yeah, the rack – so what do you – I mean, each one of those things you mentioned deserves a little conversation, so I don't know where you want to take it, but some interesting things in this. It was definitely a fun match to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think well, why don't we start with the power outage that you wanted to talk about? So where did you want to attack that one from?
Well, so here was my thought, and where I think this is important is that This was surprising. I think the big thing that stood out in this match was the number of, like you said, the number of double-digit leads that was turned around and how swingy it was. So the 191, in some ways, some people that I'm reading posts on AZ Billiards, some people are saying it wasn't even as close as it looked. Roberto never really looked like he was, you know, going to be able to win this.
That's a silly statement. I'm not trying to cut you off, but he showed at times that he could be dominating. I watched him win 10 of 11 games and not miss a ball. So, I mean, the people that say stuff like that is just silly.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking, is because when you see people where you know, they're going back and forth and nip and tuck and one or two racks at a time, then a nine-game lead is more important. But, yeah, we saw some big swings where, you know, Bergman was down 11, then he got up six games the same day. Bergman was up double digits a few times, and you know, Gomez came back. I mean, it was not uncommon to see somebody win, you know, 12 out of 14 games to get 10 ahead in a matter of 2 hours for both of them. And there was, I think somebody posted it, broke it down where this guy got up, you know, plus 7 over 9 games, and then this guy got up plus 10 over 12 games. You know what I mean? And so when you have swings like that, you sure don't feel, you know, if you're betting on Justin, which, you know, some of us were, then you sure don't feel real safe with a, you know, with a 6-game lead. Like when he came into that, even on coming into the last day with an 8-game lead, it sure didn't feel safe. But now but then again, coming down the stretch, that 8-game lead means a lot more coming into the last day than it does on the first day. But as far as the power outage, here's why I think that mattered. I was betting on Justin for the grind factor. And I already talked about this last week, but I know that Gomez might have a higher gear in terms of, you know, stringing the most racks or the most break and runs or just the most offensive firepower. So it was a matter of betting on Justin's grind exceeding Gomez's firepower. And there's a couple reasons why that nearly burned me. One is because, well, I'll get back to Gomez, but as far as the power outage, the first day, Bergman was down 22-11, but then Gomez started to fade and fatigue and wear down, and Bergman sped up as Gomez was wearing down, and he ended up going down from 22-11 down to getting ahead 35-29. It was a huge turnaround, and it was probably due a little bit to how mentally fatiguing 8-ball is. I mean, it is not a rhythm game. It is not a game where you could just autopilot, and I really feel that Bergman was grinding him out. And I thought that the tail of the story was going to be each day. And then the next day, Gomez started off by making up that deficit immediately and tying it back up. So each day, Gomez came in strong and started out shooting Bergman. But each night, I thought Bergman was going to grind him apart. So when Gomez caught up on the day two and then the power went out, I thought that was going to cost me the bet. And I think that would play a huge role in the outcome. Because if you break it down into two half, like if you break the 3 days into two half sessions and you say the first half of each day is when they're fresh, the second half of each day is when they're kind of worn. Gomez won the first half of the, you know, Gomez won the fresh part of day one. Bergman won the worn part of day two. Then on day two, I'm sorry, the worn part of day one. So Gomez won when they were fresh on day one. Bergman won when they were worn on day one. On day two, Gomez won when they were fresh. And then as things were about to shift to Bergman's worn territory, they called the match because the power outage. So they skipped the whole night on day two, where I think Bergman would have really ground him out. Then he gets to come in fresh on day three. Gomez does, gets to come in fresh on day three. And because they're extending it now to a fourth day, they've played a shorter day three, which means that, in my opinion, Justin's whole strategy of being able to get him out in deep water and where, you know, it just in terms of fatigue, it kind of got disrupted by this. You know, I feel like that really favored Gomez substantially. And if they had said, instead of playing it out over 4 days, if they'd started way early on day three and finished the whole thing on day three, I think that would have been really, really favorable to Bergman. So in the end, I think that power outage shifted things to where it kept it added a session and it gave Gomez a chance to reset, and it kept it so that it wasn't so much a game of stamina as it would have been originally. And I think that's what I thought was weird about it, is I really, really, really feel that gave Gomez a lot of life in the set that I'm not sure he would have had it been played out over 3 days.
Well, that's actually kind of an interesting thought, because I think so. My prediction for it, I think, was 181 or 182, one of the two. But I said, basically, if this was an 8-ball race to 100 with a 30-second shot clock, I think I said I predicted the match to be 192, because I did not think the talent gap was that big of a difference. But that kind of goes to what you're saying with the grind of playing against Justin Bergman. And I guess maybe I didn't think about it that way as far as that, but that might help out to get, you know, so I guess basically what I'm saying is, what do you think that shutdown for Roberto Gomez's score was? Do you think that that gave him about 10 games? Do you think it gave him 6 games? What do you think it was?
Well, it gave him a chance to win the match is what it did. Like you're saying, I don't agree with these pollsters that think that Bergman was winning the whole way. I think that I underestimated Gomez, even though I also underestimated Bergman. I'll tell you, they both played so good. I'm just in awe of how good these guys played. The break shot was the thing holding them back. But as far as getting back to your question, though, the score, how it was impacted, I think it gave Gomez a chance to win. And so the fact that he ended up at 91 is fortunate for those betting on Bergman. That power outage could have cost Bergman the match is how I feel, because you're right, with a shot clock, if you take away the fatigue, I've got some really cool stats, and Gomez, his break and run percentage is higher than Bergman's by a clip. And he showed he can play eight ball, man. That guy can play eight ball. So I don't know that Bergman had to win that set without being able to turn it into a test of fatigue. I mean, I know that Bergman can out stamina, and grind, but you take away that grind and I Gomez can play, man.
Yeah, for sure. Rob, you watched some of this with me. What'd you think, buddy?
Pardon me? What did you say?
You watched some of this with me. What'd you think?
My ear is falling off. What's that?
You watched some of this with me. What did you think?
I did watch some of this. Yes. I didn't get the first day, but the second day I watched quite a bit of it, really. Yeah, very entertaining. And yeah, great eight ball, I thought. Just on both players. I did see the slightly more confusion on the face of Roberto on racks. Starting out the racks, it looked like Justin was more aggressive in his plan for the rack each time, where I was kind of scratching my head kind of thing for Gomez on some racks. Although the racks we watched, he did have some difficult racks to get through. So you can expect that. But I wasn't too concerned, I guess, with the pace of play. We had talked about, that being a factor in the match a little bit the week before. And I thought, Bergman, he was just really dedicated on what he wanted to do, his third shot. Where do I want to be my second shot in this rack or third shot? And I liked when Bergman would go and stroke at balls that he's actually going to move on a shot. And where are they going to go? He's getting up there as if he's going to shoot that ball and it's going to hit this, go over here. And then he'd play shape and the cue ball would hit that ball right where he was stroking and show, kind of showing himself and the audience watching, You go, why is he doing that? I mean, to the average player watching that, they're maybe confused about what he's trying to do when he's walking around the table doing all that thing, Why is he shooting at the stripe?
Yeah, that's
right here.
That's
probably
a really interesting
where he
thing.
He wants to hit it with the cue ball after he goes two rails. That's where he's at with his game. I didn't quite see that same thing, although maybe he was doing it mentally in his head all with Roberto Gomez during a lot of that play, and then of course, I just thought that miss on that eight ball with. I thought Justin was going to go really jump out to a 20 game lead, and that one game turned it around when he missed that eight ball.
Yeah, and the shot you're referring to was it was kind of a jacked up the eight ball is about on the spot, and the cue ball was basically actually straight over from it, but 2 inches off the rail, and he kind of jacks up a little bit and tries to cut it at a 75 degree angle back into the corner and not scratch into the side pocket, and he missed it by a. 3/4 of a diamond. But I think that's a really interesting thing that you said about the kind of going off to the side and shooting at the stripe, because that is, it's almost like watching charades when you're watching Justin Bergman play, but instead of, you're trying to guess the object or the person, you're trying to guess the pattern. And he's very, very animated when it comes to doing that. And you really get to see an insight into what he is thinking at the table, it's very insightful for a little while. It grows on you, right? So, it gets kind of tedious. Yeah, it gets tedious after a while, but in short bursts, it's actually very interesting watching the way that he looks at all these racks, and you can see where he's getting down on a shot, and then he moves over 2 inches, and then he moves over 2 inches, and he moves over 2 inches, and then he finds exactly where he needs to be on those, you know, that 8-inch stretch of that 8-inch stretch of real estate, and then he puts the cue ball exactly on the one that he decides he wants to be on. It's neat to see for a little while. It gets tedious and annoying after a little while, but you get to see an insight into what he's thinking in a unique way that not a lot of players really offer up. So that's I do kind of like that that idea that you had there.
Yeah, I saw maybe a little more creativity, I think, from maybe Roberto in Rax in one of the games we watched.
And I think that goes to a talent dispersion as far as the game, right? Because the flashiest players in 8-ball are the people who hit things really hard and make a lot of really crazy shots, and the boring players are the ones that just stop shot on every single shot, and they find the best pattern to run out, and it's not flashy. Everything's easy.
Well, one thing that I want to kind of mention, though, you're talking about creativity, and I was thinking about break stats, and one big difference. So Bergman ran out 28% off his break.
Okay.
He ran out 28 racks out of 99 attempts. Gomez ran out 42%.
Wow.
Out of only 92 breaks, he ran 39 racks. That's so he's plus 11. You know, it was almost like he was getting an 11-game spot as far as how often he was able to run out for the break, even with less attempts. I mean, that's a huge difference. But here's the funny part. It's before you say, well, how did Bergman overcome an 11-game deficit just from, you know, without even getting to the table? But here's what I was noticing. When Gomez came up dry on the break, it was like a nuclear explosion. All the balls were all over. But Bergman Bergman was playing a softer break, he was breaking hard. But here's what was happening. Bergman's break was good enough that when he made a ball, he spread them to where he can run out. Right. But when he didn't break well and didn't make a ball, there was so much work to do for Gomez that not only was Gomez up against it in terms of trying to get out, but just in terms of how hard the racks that it was a very weird deal because you think, well, you know, I don't advise safety breaking an 8-ball because you're best off. You need to run racks from your break. But Bergman seemed to have this thing geared where when he'd make a ball, they'd be tough but runnable. But when he'd come up dry, just those extra balls not going in and just a little bit on the bottom of his range as far as how he get them.
Yeah.
It was just really tough for Gomez. And so I think that's why you saw more creativity because Gomez and why fatigue might've been an issue and why it was weird. I think that played a factor is the differences between what they left each other on their dry breaks.
Yeah. There's no question about that. Yeah. That's a good observation. And the fatigue in 8-ball. I mean, that's a big factor. I mean, when you got to think when the racks are tough, and every rack is tough. It's not like a day you break 10 times and they're all right there, gummy bear racks. I mean, they're difficult. And when every shot is weighty on the next three shots and there's five shots out there to think about, that's after 3-4 hours of that. man.
Well, and I'll tell you some of the things that really amazed me. So I wanted to mention this is that, I mean, these guys both played so pure. I mean, just really striking the balls well in terms of how the ball was crisping into the right part of the pocket with the right tip placement and the right swing speed to get the cue ball. Their cue ball speed was so dialed in. Yeah, and they had so many shots where they had to hit a certain patch or had to get a certain angle. And if they didn't, they were going to lose a turnover, an easy game, and to sit and watch the other guy barrage and lose their lead. And they just came with it again and again and again to where you forgot, you know, you'd forget that they were one slip away from losing the match or having a things turn around on them because they were just so connected to the shots and dialed in, and their speed and execution was stunning. And the other thing I would say that I thought, tell me if you guys weren't surprised, what did we see, one safety a day?
Yeah, I was going to bring this up later on, too.
The games I watched.
This was going to be the next thing that I brought up. I honestly do not remember seeing a single safety besides a desperation safety where you have no other options. There's nothing that you can wing at, and you're just basically kicking the can down the road, hoping that you get an opportunity back. I did not see a strategically played safety the entire time that I actually watched the match. I shouldn't say that. I saw a couple safeties where Gomez or Justin would try to run out and miss the eight ball or missed, their second to last ball or something like that, where the balls are easy to play positioning on or easy to play safety on, I should say. And you're just basically trying to get a better opportunity than the one that you have. But even then, I saw a lot of those opportunities where they probably should have been played. And they didn't. And Demetrius, you and I were communicating for this one where Roberto Gomez had one ball left on the table and it was sitting in the jaws of the side pocket. And the eight ball was being covered up on all sides, basically by all of Justin Bergman's balls. And instead of just pocketing that ball into the side pocket and leaving, a length of the table, three rail kick or something like that, Justin Bergman ended up shooting two or three crazy shots and hits the center of the pocket on every single one of them and runs out. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, why would you ever even try to run out? Nonetheless, get out. It just like everything I thought I knew about eight ball at that point in time was just thrown out the window. And I was just, I was infinitely confused at everything that I thought I knew about the game of pool.
Yeah. It's just for the listeners to kind of get an idea. It would be like if suppose Gomez has the eight ball and one ball of his on the table. So let's just say the eight balls is like, you can't get at it. It's on the middle of the end rail. And then Gomez's last ball is hanging in the pocket. And then Bergman's got this really tough run out where none of the balls go because Gomez is hanging balls, blocking them all. It's like anybody else that plays eight ball would just make a ball, get on a shot to where you can combo in his ball, leave your ball hanging in the pocket, leave the guy no possible shot at the eight ball. Now you've got all your balls open. They all go. The pockets are cleared. You're probably going to get ball in hand. But instead, Bergman, with Gomez's ball hanging in the pocket, so at any sense of, making an error, it's going to be game over. So Bergman bets the game on making a series of really difficult shots and running balls down the side rail, past the side pocket, short side on the other end of the table, and with thin cut angles. And just like, I'm just like, what is he doing? But then he made a ball and he gets out. I'm like, well, I don't understand. Like, I don't even have words for that. Like, it's hard to say it doesn't work because he ran out every time.
Yeah,
but it's like watching Chohan or Filler play one pocket. You're scratching your head saying, you can't shoot it, Pat.
Right. Yeah.
It was very
impressive eight ball for sure.
Yeah. It was some fantastic playing, from both
these
players.
Guys, what I noticed and what really struck me, and it does most of the time when I watch the pros play, but in eight ball, I mean, you got a lot of balls in the way a lot of time, back and forth around the table. And you got a decision to make whether to cut a ball in and do it softly and hold the ball or hit it firmly and let the ball go back and forth a couple rails between the long rails. And with amateurs, that is really can be a really tough shot because the side pockets are huge in those shots. The pros do them rarely, if ever, scratch. And always, of course, they're hitting it hard enough so the ball goes clean in the hole. You don't have to worry about nicking that long rail and shooting it too soft and, undercutting it and all of that stuff. And they just do that so perfectly. Getting it to go perpendicular to the long axis of the table, back and forth. But there's one shot to learn, I think, for amateurs is that. Cutting a ball.
Well, and I tell my students that that's the most – one of the most important shots, and I'll tell you why. There's actually a reason why that is.
Sure.
In pool, you can use good pattern play and good cue ball to avoid many, many, many difficult, not just shots, but you can work around tough shots. You can work around tough transitions to a point. But there's one type of transition you cannot work around, and that is when you have a ball on the side rail and you need to get back up table. Maybe you got a ball on the side rail and your next ball is, on the other end of the table near the end rail or just up in the kitchen or whatever. And so whatever you have, so you constantly have a ball on the side rail and then balls that you have to get shape for that are up table. And whenever that situation arises, there's no way to land on that ball to where you don't have to do something. You've got three options. You can get straight and draw back. You can get a little angle and use low outside and zigzag back. Or you can get a little more angle and use high inside and go three rails going up to the end rail and spinning back around the table. Mm-hmm. And depending on where the next ball is and where the traffic is and where you're coming from, they each have pros and cons. And I have reasons why I choose those different shots, but they're all difficult shots. And so basically what I tell my students is nine ball. And I just talk about nine ball is a series of running balls down the side rail with low outside English connected by a bunch of hangers. Because basically, that's to me, those are the only difficult shots you can't work around with good pattern play and good cue ball. So for me, nine balls is a series of running balls down the rail with low outside connected by a bunch of easy shots. And that's a big part of what I practice, and I think you can see the benefit of having those shots on lock.
Right. That puts some clarity into understanding the position of where you want to go. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, for sure. I guess, is there anything else that we wanted to discuss? I think that that knocks off all the – well, I guess I have one more thing I wouldn't mind talking about, but that as far as the match goes, that checks off all my boxes.
I was just going to mention one or two things, and these are not real. I just had an idea. It was that 8-ball was fun to watch because they get in 9-ball, there's a cap on how difficult something is. I mean, very rarely are you in a spot in 9-ball. At some point, if the shot gets too difficult, you play safe. Now, it's not strictly true. You know, top players are backed into a corner. But in 9-ball, the other thing is that you can get lucky. You know, when you miss the 1-ball, you can get lucky and the ball hooks your opponent. Or when you have a tough shot in the 7, you can kind of play a 2-way and leave the cue ball at the end rail and it might be up table. In 8-ball, there's a weird blend between you get back to the corner where you have such little, you know, defensive equity that you have to go all in on some very, very difficult shots at times because you just have no defense available. And then, unlike 9-ball, there's no way to get lucky. Like, when your opponent has 7 balls on the table and one of them's hanging and everything's wide open, like, there's just you're very exposed. So between being, I guess, pot committed or you're totally committed to just offense, you're kind of like welded to nothing but offense with no defensive merit and absolute exposure, it leads to some very difficult, exciting, dramatic situations to come up. And I know that there was a number of times I was holding my breath. I got to see people shoot at hard shots with a lot of exposure and come with some stuff. It was much more exciting than I kind of expected. I just want, and they both did it. They both came with how many times they run balls down the rail past the side with thin angles and all this stuff. So, and then I just wanted to mention for the listeners, there's one thing, Nate, I didn't talk to you about this, but I think the listeners should know. You mentioned on a podcast a couple of weeks ago that we bet on a match. Which was the last one we bet on? I already forgot.
Boosty and Chohan.
So anyway, I thought the listeners should know, like, I'm not going to go into how much we bet or who we bet on or anything, but I think it's fun. I'm going to let the listeners play along, so I'm going to tell them that Nate and I formed a little, a mutual bankroll, a shared bankroll for this set, you know, because we were talking about it. We're like, you know, we like talking about these matches. We have some opinions, and frankly, so far, we've always kind of seemed pretty close. And so we decided that we'd kind of bet on these matches together. And since we have, you know, two heads is better than one. And anyway, so I'm not going to go into the details of these things, but I will tell you, this is the third one. This is our third win, picking the horse. And this is why you guys might have mentioned something about the game spread. This is why I don't like giving up games. I like giving up odds. So nobody was wanting to bet on Gomez even, but I was not one of these guys that was giving up, you know, 15 games on the wire, 12 games on the wire. And that's why, is because it's hard to predict how these things are going to play out with, you know, but what I found is that when you give up games on the wire, it's dangerous. But if you give up odds on the money, the better player is usually a heavier favorite than people that the odds think. So in this case, I had to give up 3-2, and it got a little close. You know, I'm not saying I'm a genius for getting it in that way, but it worked out. And so we tallied up our third win. And for those that are listening along, I recommend giving up odds, not games. But all that being said, I feel like I have to do one of these disclosures. We are not a financial advising group. We can't predict the stock prices. So please, you know, be responsible. Don't, you know. Yeah, be responsible.
There was one game, I don't know if you guys watched it, one particular game, and I can't even know when it was in the match, toward the last quarter of the match, I think, but the second day, I believe, when it was a drive break, and Bergman sat down. Gomez comes up, and the balls are a mess. And there's just a lot of thinking to do, and he does, and he shoots, and he misses. So all the balls are on the table, and Bergman comes up. The ball, the cue ball's in the center of the table. Every ball is on the table. And I'm kind of watching, and he's thinking about what to do, but he doesn't go around the table four or five times planning. He just shoots, and he misses. And the cue ball runs into four or five balls. The ball he misses runs into balls, and he just goes and sits down. And I was wondering if either one of you watched that game, because I don't know what happened. Then Gomez won that game and then went on to win like four or five more after that. And I don't even know what Bergman was shooting. Usually you know what ball he's trying to pocket because there's so many balls on it.
Yeah.
And did you remember that game?
I don't, but I'll tell you what. I know that I've been in that spot where when you are putting in a certain amount, when you have your rhythm and what you're used to doing in terms of planning, which is walking around and checking an angle, making sure this ball goes, kind of just making sure that there's no trouble, you know, that you weren't expecting, you know, where you play safe for the ball, then you walk around and be like, ooh, that's a little further from the rail than I thought. I'm a little flat on this ball. You know, Justin's pretty good at that. And so it's interesting to see when he skips that. You know, you could say if he breaks and he gets to the table, he just starts shooting balls in. That's a change from his rhythm. And then the question is that because he's extremely confident or because he's not confident? Like, what is this, a good change or a bad change? And I think it's a bad change because it's kind of like this, Rob. It's kind of like, how many times have you seen this? Somebody's playing pool. They spend 25, 30 seconds a shot. They always check. They aim it. They get down smooth, steady. And then all of a sudden, they play themselves way out of line where they're going to have a really difficult cut with a hard-to-control cue ball. And all of a sudden, they just kind of, like, jump down and shoot it. And it's like they're not rushing because they're comfortable. They're rushing because either because they're uncomfortable, they want to get it over with, and also possibly because they're trying to convince the audience and themselves that I'm not in trouble here. And so to me, when Justin slows down or when Justin like just starts shooting balls, to me, that's actually some cracks in the armor where either he's fatigued or I think that when people have open tables that are very runnable, they say my dad was a rock climber and they say that more climbers die in the descent, meaning after they've climbed the mountain or whatever, the rock climb, then they're walking down the hike on the way back down from the back of the cliff, and they trip and fall and get killed. And the reason for that is because they're fatigued and they've let their guard down. They've completely let their guard down. All the adrenaline's out, they're fatigued, and they make a careless mistake, and their backpack throws them out of balance. And so it's like, to me,
an eight ball too. The guy cuts two balls in, makes a carom shot and misses a straight in eight ball.
So when you see Bergman have an open rack and just start shooting balls, it to me it's a sign of fatigue and a sign that of pressure and a sign that he's weird. It's a crack in the armor.
Okay, that's what happened.
All right. Well, I think we can leave this there and we can move on to the end of the podcast. And we have another fan question. Yay! All right, so this is going to be and we're going to skip over the discussion topic because we're, again, at a pretty good amount of time in the podcast right now. We will go with a listener question now from Terry Horton, and he has actually been reaching out to the podcast every now and then with some really insightful stuff, so I appreciate that, Terry. And this is going to be his question. There's league night, local or regional tournaments, and sometimes a bigger open-style event like Derby City Classic or League Championship in Vegas, let's say. How does one prepare for bigger events when you realistically have little chance? I've sabotaged any chance of doing moderately good at Derby, perhaps because of low expectations. Let's say you decided to enter the U.S. Open. If you play well and you draw reasonably, you can win a round or two. But what if you don't really believe that? The question is, what does a plan look like to prepare for each type of event? So I think that the gist of this is, He plays in big events and he plays in small events, and the idea of feeling like you belong is big in his preparation, and he wishes it wasn't, I guess. So how do you prepare for a bigger event that you don't have a chance in versus a smaller event that I guess you do have a chance in? Anybody want to take it on first? Rob?
Well, this is this is brutal. Personally, if I'm going to a tournament for any reason at all, I prepare exactly the same way. Get my head straight, why I'm there, what I want to accomplish when I'm there, where do I want to draw the line between the overall experience of playing in the tournament and the experience of competing. I kind of, as I aged, I had that planned out differently each time. As I get a little older, now it's more about the experience than it is the outcome. So that would have to be taken into consideration. If you're going there to win the thing, then, and every tournament's like that, whether it's a local light thing or a heavy important tournament, that's kind of up to you to find your spot and how you want to prepare for that, what fits your personality, and of course your what kind of outcome you want from it. If you know you can't win it, you still have to have a plan. So what's my answer to that? Find out what your particular plan is. That would be my answer.
Yeah. And Demetrius, if you don't mind, I'll take this one on second. Picking up basically right where you left off, Rob, I've been working with a younger kid from the UW-Madison. His name's John. And we've been going to the same weekly tournament for the last couple weeks now. And he sent me a text message saying that he's feeling pretty good about his game. And his goal for this tournament coming up is fourth place. And I texted him, we need to have a conversation tonight, basically. And we need to have a conversation about goal setting. And Demetrius, you cover this a lot, but I guess I've had this perfect example of it very recently where he wanted to get fourth place in this tournament. And it turns out that there was 22 people that ended up showing up, and he played well. He played well in his first match and lost. And he lost because he was playing just a better player, I mean a more seasoned player, but he played well. And then he went on a little bit of a tear on the one loss side. He ended up winning, I think, three or four matches, but he didn't play great. He played against some lower quality players, and he just didn't feel great about his game. And then he lost another game against a good player. He lost a match against a good player, but played well. So then he goes to a tournament at Friday night at the Sussex Bowl in, well, I guess Sussex, Wisconsin. And he goes 2-0, but he said that was the best pool he's played in forever. I mean, that's the best pool he remembered playing. And this was right after I had this conversation with him on the Thursday night, basically saying, yes, you want to go into a tournament having expectations of this spot, right? So I want to go into this 8-person pool tournament and finish above 50%. But that doesn't take into account the way that your opponents play against you. So the only thing that you can do is control the things that you can control and feel like the game that you put out there is good. So you can go to the U.S. Open and lose 9-0 and still feel like you played well. Or you could win 5-0 against, you know, a local player and feel like you played the worst pool that you ever could play in your entire life. So I don't like to let people try to set expectations based off of the field around them. I like to try to get people to set their expectations based off of what their likely and realistic goals for their game are individually. So what your opponent does to you and what your opponent does with the overall score means nothing as far as your expectations on yourself. And that's what I would say is to you, Terry, is yes, they're bigger events, and so you want to put a little bit more emphasis into them. But what your opponent does to you, you can't help it if your opponent breaks 7-out in a winner break tournament, and you know there's nothing you can really do about it. So just set your expectations based off of your game and what you can control.
All right, and I'll jump in here and I'll say that I'd even go one further, which is this expectation is such an amazing word when it comes to pool preparation and mental game, because I think that this is a sign, because I don't even think he's saying, how do I prepare so I can go in there and win? Because then you're saying, well, maybe you can't control that. And you're right. I agree. You've heard my talk. That's a result. You can't control results. You've got to control processes and in the short term. And so that's great. But I hear a lot of what I hear him asking isn't even how do I go win, but how do I prepare so that I can go and perform in these regional and large or these national size tournaments and perform with the same level of comfort and performance and execution that I'm used to being able to call upon myself when I'm playing where I'm comfortable against local players. That's what I hear him asking. I understand I can't win. I know I can't force wins and beat all these top champions all the time, but how do I at least go play my game, not be nervous and overwhelmed and intimidated, and give myself a chance? And I actually challenge that. I say, why do you think that's even possible? And I'm not mad. Of course that's our desire. It's a desire that we can go play our game against, you know, anybody in the world and just not be intimidated. But to ask the question implies that we think that there's an answer that's like, man, if there's just some way, you know, like everybody else is going to choke. Everybody else is going to get nervous. Every other pool player in the world is going to be intimidated. Every other pool player in the world is going to take them years and years and years and dozens of pro tournaments to get gradually more and more acclimated through experience and through, you know, through learning from mistakes and spewing away opportunities and having 8-hour drive homes where you kind of just ruminate about that shot you dogged, and, you know, you spend your entire weekend to put yourself in a spot and miss the shot. And why did I let this bother me that he was this good player? And I, you know, like everybody else is going to go through that, but there's got to be a way I can do it, because I'm me, and I'm going to solve the puzzle, and I'm going to find the right mindset, and I'm not going to choke, and I'm going to bypass all that and just find the right. It's like, now on the one hand, I admire people for trying to reach out and say, how did champions think? How do you approach these things? But the answer is, there's no way that you're not going to go through. It would be like if a beginning player said, look, I want to learn pool. I'm good at golf. How do I prepare myself to go play pool where I just don't miss? It's like, no, you're going to miss a lot of balls. So start swinging. And that's how I feel about this type of thing. It's like, you're going to go to national level competition. Yes, there are things you can do to prepare, and I could talk about that. But the main thing is to budget for loss. And I think that to have this idea that we can transcend pressure, that's not realistic. And whatever, you guys have heard it from me before, my entire mental game approach is reality-based. And I think when we start thinking that there's some way to transcend all this, that's just not realistic. We're all human. It's pressure's real. So the answer is, I would not even expect that I'm going to perform at a national level the same way I would perform at a local level. And sometimes it goes good, sometimes it goes bad. There are things I would do to prepare, and I can talk to you about those things, but that's a lofty expectation that I would just take right off the table. So not only would I not care about results, about winning and losing, I think being emotionally attached to this idea that I have to perform well and I cannot let the pressure get to me more than it would in a local tournament, I think that that's out of your control every bit as much as winning and losing. And I would take all that off the table, say the goal is not to win. The goal is not even to play your game. The goal is to try to have fun trying to play your game while you're up against a series of pressure situations of which you've never experienced before and are not totally ready for and don't know what to expect. So you're going to be off the maps and you're going to be fighting opponents, you know, emotional demons that you've never faced before. So go in, do your best and learn and start to learn the lay of the land. That's what I think.
Yeah. And you read the question differently than I did. And I guess it's just an interpretation of the question. So I like the way that you interpret it. I wouldn't mind addressing it, because there are things that I like to do in this situation that helps me out. And it kind of goes back to the inner game of tennis. It always goes back to the inner game of tennis when it comes to pool, generally speaking. And what I find is when I'm playing against players, so this is kind of how I look at it. There are levels of players, right? Not everybody's the same level of player. You kind of have these beginner players, the serious beginner players, the low average league players, middle league players, top league players, semi-professionals, shortstops, and then professional players. There's more that go in there, but the idea is when you're playing against different categories of these players, depending on where you're at in that each discourse of those different categories, it becomes intimidating when you leave your category and go up. So, for example, I would consider myself a top league player to maybe even like a very, very, very low-end shortstop. But I had to play against a top amateur this weekend, a shortstop, and I was very, very unnerved in the first few games. And then what I did was after game three, I'm down 3-0. And what I did is I just kind of sat back. I threw some headphones in, and what I did was I turned my mind off. So I got to the point where I just stopped thinking about it, and I just tried to play the game of pool that I'm been so conditioned to play for so long and just stop thinking about, hey, I'm playing against this player. This is a really good player. I cannot make any mistakes at all. And it's very hard to do in the moment, but if you could just turn your mind off and play the game that you've played your entire life and that you're conditioned to play without letting your mind get involved in it, it makes it easier, at least for me. So the Inner Game of Tennis kind of talks about that with when it says, just get out of your body's way. It's really, really good at breathing. It's really, really good at walking. And it's really, really good at anything that you've, you know, dedicated your entire life to learning how to do. Usually when you get yourself in trouble is when you let your mind get in the way. So if you could bring the context back down to where it's supposed to be, that generally helps too.
Nice.
I guess from here, we can leave that discussion there. That covers up our two
and
tips.
And I'll be waiting for the prolotherapy phone call, and I will answer it.
There you go, Dave. You need to call.
Out
you
there
need to call
in pool land. If you have muscle aches and pains or problems, let me know.
Yeah. So, Dave, you have his number. Call him and leave him a message. And if he ghosts you again, I'll probably just drive up there and just kick him in the shin for you.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we can move on from there. Demetrius, you ready to do your coach's corner?
Yeah, let's do it. And today I'd like to – this is kind of inspired me, this question, because there's a lot that I can say. And so I'm going to use some coach's corners here to kind of do a series that I've had in my mind that I've put off. And here's why I've put it off. Is mental game stuff is very difficult to talk about. Because some people don't really like to even think about it. They're like, yeah, whatever, it doesn't exist, or they think they know it all, or just be the ball, whatever. And then the other problem is, it's like a game of telephone between the ideas in my mind to how I'm able to articulate it, to how people hear it, and then how they relate it to their experience. And so by the time it comes done, it's very easy for something that's really real and important and powerful for me to come across as kind of gobbledygook and just kind of sound like weird. So I'm going to try very, very hard. And I'd like a leap of faith for some people to come along with me on this ride. So today I will start by talking about, what I'm going to do is talk about my general attitude towards adversity today. And then over the next few coaches corners, I'm going to be speaking to specifically how I use my overall outlook to help in different difficult situations that might arise, such as being intimidated by a better player, or being, you know, afraid of being, you know, losing, or being afraid of missing a ball, or, you know, just different things that all the different situations that can come up. It's almost like dead stroke. Like there's a certain mindset that I want to have. And then I use these tactics to help allow me to get back into that mindset. So to start with, I will say, welcome to another Coach's Corner. This is Demetrius Gelatis. I'm with MN Pool Bootcamp. That's me. So you can email me questions at info@mnpoolbootcamp.com or check out my website to find out how I do my 3-day trainings. But in any case, what I want to talk about is attitude towards adversity. And it all starts, all my mental game stuff starts with reality-based and accepting reality. It's all about accepting reality. And I think that there's a couple problems that people have when it comes to adversity, is that a lot of people, they don't really embrace and accept the reality of what we're doing here. And so I was thinking about this, and here's the way I explained it to one guy. I was like, hey, the game is supposed to be hard. Like if we pictured for a minute, I feel like the Twilight Zone picture, if you will, a world in which suppose we didn't have rails on the table. And the game was that we just shot into balls and knocked them off the table. That would be a game that would be pretty boring because you'd never miss. Or if the game started with all the six balls hanging in the corners and you just had to run around the table and shoot those six balls in, it would be very boring. The game wouldn't be fun because it's not challenging. And it's just, you'd lose interest. It's just not even a game because a game implies, you know, or requires an element of risk and a certain amount of loss. So what do we do in pool? What makes pool a great game is that the balls aren't all hanging, and that we have an eight ball. We have clusters that we have to break open and balls that block pockets so that we have to get short side. And when that happens, what do we do? Do we go to the pool hall saying to ourselves, I hope every time I break, nothing is touching a rail and nothing is blocking another ball and everything's hung up so I'm not challenged at all today? Is that what we're hoping? No, we say to ourselves, I am going to try to bring the skills that I've developed to try to overcome those challenges. And that's what we do is we've learned in pool. We've identified. So these are some key patterns, guys. Number one, we've identified what are the challenges we're likely to face. We identify that we're likely to face balls that block other pockets, and we're likely to face balls that are tied up, and we're likely to face, you know, some difficult shots or some difficult cue ball positional shots. So then we've identified those challenges. And then we spent our years of playing pool developing the skills to overcome those challenges. Maybe we learned to bank the balls, or maybe we learned to get short side or tighten up our cue ball and play good patterns. So then when we go to the pool hall, we're not sitting there saying, I hope nothing's tied up today. We go there with kind of an attitude that says, I hope that I'm going to look forward to challenging myself to use the skills that I've developed to overcome the challenges that I'm likely to encounter. And that's what I'm going to, I enjoy that. Like, that's what I'm looking forward to. That's why I play this game. But for some reason, people enjoy testing their physical skills that they've developed to overcome physical challenges. But they hate testing their mental skills against mental challenges. And so for some reason, when people play a match, they're like, man, I was feeling pressured. I can't believe I thought that. I hate it when I get nervous. I just hate that. Or it's like, man, is this guy is intimidating too bad? I can't stand that. Or, you know, there was distractions going around and I was distracted by life. And that just, I wasn't even able to get in the match. And they're like mad about it. And I'm like, when you play pool, there are physical challenges and there are mental challenges. And you have to handle them the same. And so I will start by saying a couple things. One, anything between you and the finish line is part of the game. So that means that if you've got, you know, if your boss is texting you something and that's distracting you, then that is part of the pool game every bit as much as the shot you're about to take on, because it's a challenge between you and the finish line that you have to deal with. So anything between you and the finish line, fatigue, waitresses that are, you know, asking you, do you need another drink during your shot? Whatever it is, that's part of the game because it's between you and the finish line. So the first rule is anything between you and the finish line is part of the game. The second thing is that your attitude towards that has to be to learn to identify what are the non-physical things between you and the finish line that have in the past impacted your performance. How do you identify those things? How do you develop your skills to overcome those things? And then when you go to play, you're not sitting there saying, gosh, I hope I don't get nervous tonight. Because when you go to a tournament saying, and this is kind of ties back to our listener question, if you go to a tournament saying, boy, I hope that thing doesn't happen where I'm playing good players and I get intimidated and I can't count on different parts of my game and I'm nervous while losing, I hope that doesn't happen. To me, that's the same as saying, I hope I get a bunch of easy shots tonight. Whereas I feel like a champion says to themselves, I'm likely to be in those situations. I'm looking forward to using this mental strategies and skills that I've developed to take on head on some of those challenges so that I can find out, you know, so I can test myself. And that's part of the game. That's what I love. And so that's what I would say is that the big problem why a lot of people have poor mental games is because they don't treat it the same as they treat the physical game. They resent it. They either deny that it's real by saying, oh, I don't feel pressure, or they resent that it's real by being upset when they succumb to these things. And because they get upset or they deny its existence, they never identify what's sinking them and develop strategies to overcome it. So my whole point here is to welcome mental adversity into the game, make it as every bit as real and meaningful as physical adversity, and don't treat it any differently. So then as we go into the future here on these episodes, I can talk a little bit about what some of that mental adversity is, how it plays out, how I try to overcome it. But before I leave, I guess I'll just talk about your attitude towards adversity in general, which is adversity, not only is it what makes the game real, that is where you can gain an edge on your competition. Because if there was no physical pressure, I'm sorry, if there was no physical challenge and if there was no mental challenge, if the game was super easy and you were not tested, not only would it not be enjoyable for you, how could you ever beat anybody? Nobody would ever miss. Nobody would ever choke. Nobody would ever struggle. And so the champion looks at adversity as a good thing, because adversity is what makes it so that not everybody can succeed, so that the person that prepares and tries and, you know, more valiantly will then end up winning. So if you want to win, adversity is critical because it's the only way that you can lose your competition. If it was all easy, everybody would tie it for first. And so when you see things that are difficult, you need to get excited and say, I love this adversity. This is where I get to shine. In other words, if you're running a race where everyone's running neck and neck and neck the whole way until you get to that obstacle that you got to scramble over. And that's when you see people start sorting out into first and last. Without that obstacle, you can't take the lead. And so when you see the obstacle, you have to realize this is where you can actually get an edge and get a lead on your competition. And so this is not bad. This is your chance to lose your competition by handling this adversity better than your peers. And so when I experience adversity, and I, you know, of course, when I'm in a good state of mind, my attitude is bring it on. The more the merrier, make it tough. And this is my chance to lose my competition. What? And so I boil it all down to watch this. In my mind, when things get tough, I think to myself, watch this. Now is my chance to lose my competition. Watch how well I respond. Sometimes I look up at the sky and say, is this all you got? Make it tougher. Let's, you know, give me the wrench, the Goodwill Hunting. You know, I take the wrench. Like, let's make it really, really hard. Because even if I don't succeed in this moment, I know that my attitude towards this and my response towards this is going to give me an edge. And this is where how I handle this is going to give me an edge over my competition. And that's how I lose my competition a lot of the time. So that's my overall approach to adversity. It's part of the game. Mental adversity is part of the game. I embrace it. I identify it. I try to overcome it. And I'm grateful for it because it's my only chance to actually win anything ever. And so it's not always at the same time. You face adversity one day that they might not face. So it doesn't even out in the moment, but it evens out in the long run. And so that's the part you just have to have faith that it may not even out rolls this set, but in the end, the person that has the better attitude towards adversity is going to usually do really well. So that's my part one. Now in the next part of these coaches' corners, I'll be talking specific different types of adversity you might face and how specifically you can handle that. So very good. That's what I got.
I'm hungry. I don't know why that's relevant. Is Rob still here? Did Rob leave us again?
Maybe.
Rob doesn't like us. Oh. Rob never hangs around for us.
Yeah, I don't blame him, man. So he's a smart man.
God, why don't I get to leave? This is dumb. This isn't fair.
Yeah.
It's all right. Someone's got to be around to give you some moral support. So here I am. Well, Demetrius, another week has come to a close.
It always goes that way. I try to stop the hand of time, and the sun just keeps on revolving around the earth, which is the center of the universe. What am I? I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm ready to call it a day.
They're just flat, I thought.
Yeah, Max Everly. Too soon? Okay.
All right, off we go. Let's get out of here.
See all right. Later. It's been a pleasure, Nate. Thanks for everybody for listening. Talk to you guys next week.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.